The content of this podcast should not be considered financial or investment advice. All interviews and discussions are opinions only, and the podcast has been created without taking into consideration the listener's financial objectives, financial situation, or needs. Listeners should obtain independent advice before making any financial decisions. Hello, and welcome to this edition of Stockhead's Rock Yarn. I'm your host, Peter Strachan. Today we're studying Sweden's minerals resources industry, and to walk us through the opportunities and challenges that come with operating in that nation, we are pleased to welcome Peter George, who is the recently elevated Managing Director of ASX-listed company Alicanto Minerals. Welcome, Peter.
Great. Thanks very much, Peter. Glad to be here.
Can we start by asking you to tell us how you came to be working in Sweden?
Yeah, well, that's a long story, that one. I'll try to keep it short, but basically I was in the pub in the School of Mines in Kalgoorlie with my father, and we ended up having a conversation with, I think it was Professor Spottiswood, who was the director of the School of Mines at the time, and so they were looking for students to go to Sweden on an exchange program. And Dad and I had had a couple of beers, and we looked at each other and said, what do you think? It sounds like a good idea. And then off I went.
Okay, well, there you are. And now when we think about mining deep into the dark Swedish mountains, it's easy to call up images of the mountain folk from Lord of the Rings. So but what are the nation's mining towns really like?
Oh, look, I mean, I'm a Kalgoorlie born and bred boy, so I'm used to operating in mining towns around the world, and I don't think Sweden's really that different. You know, you get probably people a little bit quieter. But, you know, these are passionate people that enjoy living out in the bush and, you know, enjoy their outdoor sports. You know, there's a lot of snowmobiling and snowboarding and skiing and skating and, you know, just lots of outdoor stuff.
Yeah, I think the plains folk from the goldfields in Kalgoorlie are probably a bit more scarier than the Lord of the Rings folk with their axes and swords.
Oh, it could be.
So Sweden has an exceptionally long history of mining for gold and base metals. Uh-huh. Historically, what has formed the backbone of Sweden's mining industry, and where are the exploration and production focuses now in that country?
Yeah, well, I mean, like you say, Sweden's history of mining goes back over 1,000 years. And you know, you've got the really large iron ore mines right up in the north, you know, the high-grade iron mines up there in Kiruna and Malmberget. And then in the middle part of the upper part of the middle part of Sweden, you've got the Skellefteå field, where you've got some quite large VMS and gold deposits up there. And then more in the middle or southern part around the Stockholm region, you've got the Bergslagen district. And these are the three major producing areas. You know, and all three of them, the history goes back, you know, 1,000 years. You know, you've got, for example, the Falun mine, which is right next door to our tenement package, you know, which was closed in 1992. That was effectively was known as the Bank of Sweden. You know, the whole of the Swedish economy was based upon the copper resources that were in the ground and then being mined at Falun. And then quite similar to the Sala mine, which was the big silver, very high-grade deposit that they had down there about 150 kilometres away.
Yeah, so just to put that into perspective, the listener would be interested to know that Falun was 24 million tonnes, I think, at 4% copper, 4 grams a tonne of gold, and about 7% combined lead and zinc with a bit of silver thrown in. So that is a very, very rich ore body.
Yeah. Talking about our project a little bit, that's exactly what we're looking for, repeats of the Falun and the targets that we're looking at. You know, we're very positive that we're on the right track to finding another one.
And so Sweden has developed not just mining skills but also the downstream smelting capabilities as well, and those still are operating there.
The majority of the smelting capability is up there in the north, where in the Luleå and the Skellefteå part of the world. I'm not sure of what tonnages they've got, but yeah, huge tonnages that they get run and processed through that part of the world.
So let's look at the sort of downstream area a bit more. Can you tell us about the mining and services industries that have grown in Sweden, many of which have expanded to become global and multinational names?
Yeah, well, of course, you've got probably the two biggest ones, being Atlas Copco and Sandvik, that are based out of that part of the world. It's actually quite fortunate as a young mining engineer to get sponsored by Atlas Copco to go and have a tour of some of the mines and their factories over there, and you know where they've come from to where they are today is just amazing. The technology that these guys provide, I think the Australian mining industry benefits from hugely. And then obviously you've got all of the smelting and the processing technology that's come out of the likes of Outokumpu and those sorts of companies as well.
And Boliden, and of course there's Alfa Laval that makes screens and filters and so forth as well. So it's interesting to think of a country the size of Sweden, 8 million, 9 million people. They have really world-leading mining services, mining equipment, mining technology companies. And I think really Australia also, it's not as well known, but Australia's some of the computer services and the geological modelling and so forth technologies that we have, and the companies are world-leading as well.
No, most definitely. And that's quite interesting comment, actually, because I don't even remember when I was over there working in Sweden, the software side of things wasn't nearly as advanced as what we were already operating with in Australia. But I think there's been some cross-pollination going back in that direction as well over the last 10 years, so it's good to see.
Yeah, sometimes there's a bit of a cultural cringe in Australia and we think everyone else is better, but in fact we do lead the world in those areas. So Sweden has been particularly severely impacted by the current coronavirus pandemic. Can you tell us how the local economy is progressing and how this impacts Alicanto's ability to work in the country?
Well, I'll answer the second part of that first. So we're not being impacted at all, except that I can't get over there. But, you know, we have Eric, being my chief geologist over there in Sweden. You know, he's going, started a recent drilling program. Now, so we're not having any issues over there with regards to getting hold of equipment and people, and that's because the Swedes, you know, they have been impacted by it, but they haven't closed down their economy. Obviously, they've been affected by the downturn in the world economy, but I think their local economy is still quite strong, and in many ways not too dissimilar to how things are in Western Australia here, even though obviously at the opposite end of the scale where we don't have any COVID at this point in time.
Yeah. So to what extent are Swedish exploration activities weather dependent? I mean, here in Australia, you know, you've got the wet season up north, but pretty much you can work all around. It doesn't matter whether you want to work in 45 degree heat, you can. But, you know, what happens in Sweden?
Yeah, well, it's just at the opposite end of the temperature scale. So, you know, the gear is built for operating in, I guess, minus 40 degrees up to, you know, 30, 40 degrees positive. So, look, it's not really that big a deal. I think there's the equipment operates all year round. I mean, you have the big Aitik copper mine in the north of Sweden, not far from Malmberget and Kiruna. You know, and these guys, it's a big open pit. So all the gear is, you know, it's just set up for operating in those type of temperatures, and they operate 365 days a year. I think that there's more of an issue around the moose hunting season, you know, when you don't particularly want to be an explorer or a geologist walking around in the bush with a few thousand mad Swedes running around with big guns. So we tend to pull everybody out at that stage, but that's only for about a week.
Yeah, oh, yeah. You can weatherize your drilling equipment, but it's hard to make them bulletproof, I guess.
That's right.
Can you outline the company's exploration plans around the historic Falun gold and copper mine?
Yeah, I can. So we've started a 4,000-metre program about 2 weeks ago, which we announced at the RIU conference about 2 weeks ago.
You and I were both attending, yes.
That's right, yeah. That was a good couple of days. It was actually nice to get out after being locked away for 6 months. But, yeah, so that's it. So we've got one rig up there operating at the moment. That'll be somewhere between 25 and 35 holes. So they're all quite short holes. So we're testing, at this stage we have about 15 targets in front of us, and within each of those targets, each one of those has at least three or four conductor plates, or we've seen copper gold skarn, proximal copper gold skarn at surface. So we've got a huge amount of work in front of us, and I'm fully expecting that program is likely to expand as we go.
So are there any access issues around topography and local landholders?
Look, we're dealing with tier one mining jurisdictions here, same as what we do in Australia. So
yeah.
You just have to expect that there are going to be there is red tape that you have to get through. But as long as you understand what that red tape is, it's really not that much of a problem. So, and I've operated in both Australia and in Sweden. I've even operated in other parts of the world where there is no red tape. So I don't see it as a major issue. Yes, sometimes it can cause delays, but as I mentioned to you, we've got so many targets. You know, if we do happen to come across a particular issue in one target, we just move over to the next one while that bit of paperwork's being sorted out, and off we go. So I think from my perspective, all the applications that we've put in, we've had about three quarters of them have come back successfully now, and we're still waiting on a couple more. None of them have been rejected at this stage.
And the topography, do you have to bulldoze roads in, or is it, you know, fairly good access for the equipment?
No, we prefer, you know, I'm a bit of a greenie at heart, so I prefer not to knock over trees if I can avoid it. But look, this is heavily forested areas. Luckily enough, in the majority of the areas that we are drilling in old forested areas. So they have been, the trees have been cut down and have grown back again. So there are logging roads, giving us a fair amount of access into the areas that we want to get to. And we're not, you know, we just tend to pick our way through the trees. And if we do have to knock any vegetation over, then, you know, we have to pay for that vegetation through to the landowners themselves. That's part of the rules.
Okay. So I was interested to read, Peter, that the geology and mineralisation genesis at Falun has recently been reinterpreted after, you know, hundreds of years of mining and exploration in the air. Why did the Swedes take so long to make that switch from volcanogenic massive sulfide to a skarn type morphology?
Yeah, look, it's a really interesting story that, and I talked to Eric about it quite a bit, and he's actually quite embarrassed for his profession that you know, this has been here for 1,000 years and it's just been sitting under everybody's noses. But you know, there's a few things that people need to keep in mind. So 1992 is a very important year, which is the same year that the Falun mine itself was actually closed. But at that time, you also, prior to 92, you needed to be either a Swede or a Swedish company to own tenements within the country. And then also in 1992, you were, prior to that, you were not legally obliged to provide any of your exploration data through to the government for safekeeping or for future generations. So you can just imagine that you've got the Falun mine, it's all closed down. The company that owned Falun, called Stora Kopparbergen, they actually changed into a timber company. And, you know, basically all that information has just been lost or gone into geologists' private stashes, of which Eric has got some himself. And then on top of that, you know, there's a certain amount of laziness as well. You know, you've had the big boys in there like Boliden and Lundin, you know, having a look around. They've had some beautiful big ore bodies in there, such as in Garpenberg and at Zinkgruvan. So they've been a little bit spoilt with regards to what they've had in front of them. You know, these are great big ore bodies that have been poking out of the ground, and they've been mining these things for the best part of 1,000 years. But so they haven't really looked – nobody's really looked that closely since 1992 in this entire area. But, you know, when we first came in and had a look at this, we were of the understanding that it was, you know, volcanogenic massive sulfides as well. You know, we found, about 45 kilometres of limestone mineralised zone with high-grade grab samples at surface, and we followed that and, you know, we confirmed those assays in our own right. Then the more we looked, the more we realised that we weren't dealing with volcanogenic massive sulfides. That's when we had our discovery hole at the Wolf Mountain mine or deposit, if you like to call it, where we intersected distal copper gold skarn, which was a real eureka moment for Eric. Once we then realised what we were dealing with, we went off and pegged another 150 square kilometres of ground, and we're now up to over 70 kilometres of limestone-hosted mineralised zone. And I think we're at, last count, we're up to about 10 copper gold skarns with their own causative intrusions within the about 15-kilometre radius of each other, which is just phenomenal.
So it's been a real benefit in a way, because this it shows you the disadvantages of locking something up in a sort of socialist utopia. And we've seen examples in China where their gold mining industry, once they opened it up to new technologies and involvement from other sources, it boomed. And the same thing in the Cooper Basin, where Santos basically had the thing locked up for 40 or 50 years. And when that was opened up, all of these new technologies and new ideas and interpretations led to massive new discoveries of oil and gas in the Cooper Basin. Well, so, 100%. You know, you're in a situation now where I've noticed you've got some very high grade rock chip samples and thin zones there. And it's now a matter of finding out, you know, where there's commercial mineralization.
Yeah, correct. You know, we know that we're looking in the right places. We've re-engineered, for want of a better word, you know, the geology in the area, and we've got our targets. You know, and now obviously one of the other things that perhaps I forgot to mention is that, given that we're listed on the ASX as well, we've also got the ability to raise the money. So we've got a significant amount of money in the bank now. You know, the Swedes just don't have that ability outside of the big boys to actually raise the money to do large exploration programs. So, you know, and given my link with Sweden, you know, I can speak Swedish. You know, I've got mates in there that are managing directors of the big companies. So having access to that, as well as having Eric, who's found six of these, you know, major discoveries in his own right within Sweden, you know, it's just, you don't get these type of opportunities in your career too often.
Yeah, so Alicanto has employed geochemical and scout sampling, as you've said, along with ground EM geophysical surveys. What do you think seems to be the best drill targeting method that you've identified so far?
I think it's boots on the ground by far. And this is another reason why things are still sitting there, because on the geophysical point, it's a good tool, but it's not the be-all and end-all, because, you know, even you can go out there and you can drill the biggest, brightest anomaly and it comes back as a great big piece of pyrite. But, you know, if you don't understand what that pyrite means, you're going to miss a great big pyrite, the great big chunk of pyrite ore body sitting right next to it. So an example. So, you know, the ability to, and Eric's been out there, he's visited over 2,000 outcrops and old workings going back into the 1600s and 1700s at surface to formulate these ideas. And we've been very fortunate for him to be able to spend that time. But then on top of that, you know, we've done some, you know, some deals in the background for basically to get hold of about $2 million worth of geophysical information for nothing. We've reprocessed all of that. So we received that from about four or five different sources, reprocessed it all into the one location, and now we're overlaying that information over the top of the, you know, the boots on the ground geology work that Eric has done, and it's just amazing to see now. You know, we're getting these big magnetic signatures lighting up, you know, which could either be causative intrusions or they could be ore bodies themselves. You know, we're getting large EM conductor plates sitting within the limestone mineralized zone that we can see at surface. It just doesn't get any better than that from an exploration perspective.
Yeah, so as I said, you've found these high grades of copper and golds at the surface, and you've got the skarns, rock chip samples. What's the plan now to test for commercial mineralization, and what's the company's budget for the next 2 years to do that?
Yeah. So, look, our plan at the moment is that we want to test each one of these targets. You know, we're in the fortunate position of we're actually developing targets quicker than we can drill them. So we're looking at other methods to increase our program and to get some high speed into our program. But I'll come into that in a later date. But, you know, at the moment, we've got a 4,000-meter drilling program, which will take us through to the end of December, and that's only about a $600,000 Aussie program. You know, we've got $3.3 million in the bank, so we've got money, which will, even if we doubled our drilling program, we'll have money through to the end of next year. I have no issues.
And you'll be coming back with some results basically through to the end of this calendar year as well for your shareholders.
Correct. Mm.
All right, so that's a pretty interesting program, I have to say, Peter. And, of course, you've also in the background got some pretty exciting sort of elephant country permits in Guyana in South America, and although that's not at the forefront of activity at the moment.
No, I mean, Guyana's a fabulous place. You know, it's all part of the Guiana Shield, which is the same geology as West Africa. You know, we've got about 300 square kilometres of elephant country, as you call it, out there. There's been, I'm not sure of the total amount, but over $30 million worth of drilling expenditure in the area on our tenements over the last 15, 20 years. We're running a process at the moment. It's not our focus, but we hope that by the end of the year we're going to have a direction with regards to what it is that we're going to be doing with those projects. Obviously, with the price of gold as it is today, you know, these have got some serious value, which, interestingly enough, I don't think we're getting any benefit from in our market capitalization. So that's something to look forward to for our shareholders.
Yeah, and you're surrounded by a couple of multi-million ounce deposits there. So it's good hunting ground for the company. So, Peter, thank you very much for coming in and talking to us at Stockhead today on the Rock Yarn, and we'll look forward over the next 6 months, hopefully get you back in and we can talk to some of the results that you're going to be delivering.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for your time, Peter.